So all of this started, we've been looking for a place to actually record a conversation between us, because we have conversations like this all the time. And we were really just waiting for the next one to come around and capture it and try to get it on audio. So
yeah,
that just happened. Two nights ago now, we mm-hmm. were just talking about Stranger Things season 3, which just came out at the time of this recording. And Nick, you were telling me you were really enjoying the season and riffing on some connections you had with Vaporwave. So why don't we start there?
Yeah, for sure. So quick intro on who I am. I'm Nick Fuller, and I have been best friends with you, Jeremy, since we were children, since we were like 11 years old. And we've been best friends talking online basically every day, inseparably, ever since. Being the little dweeby little philosophers that we were back in the day, we've continued that into our own professional careers. And I work in IT as one of my jobs. And then one of my other jobs is I work actually for a virtual reality hardware company in Orlando, Florida. So I'm a big tech geek and just a big geek in general. As sort of a quick like version of my background there, you know, I was watching Stranger Things, and you know, I've watched every season as they come out so far, one by one. There was just something about this third season that was just, I mean, like, it's overused, but it was like literally blowing my mind. Every single episode was, it was just doing it for me. Like, I was just enthralled. I loved the way that the characters were going. And, you know, maybe that's because I was a little disappointed in how the most recent season or seasons of Game of Thrones have gone. So it was, like, amazing to see a show still continuing to be good quality into its third season when plenty of shows only had good firsts and then terrible second, thirds, and so ons, you know? So it could just be that as somebody that has watched TV shows, I was, like, really happy that the quality hadn't gone down, the acting hadn't gone down, the budget got bigger, but the artistic integrity didn't get smaller. And so I actually started my conversation with you because I wanted Stranger Things stuff. So, you know, like hyper consumerism obviously is like essentially an integral part of all tech geekiness. So I'm just going to throw it out here right now that like I buy stuff and it's very bad for the environment, but I buy a lot. And I buy geeky stuff, and I have two glass cabinets full of like little mini figurines and things like that. So, but I don't have anything Stranger Things. And so I was like, man, I just love this whole series right now. What's out there right now that is Stranger Things, and what are people making, and are there official company like partnerships for products or whatever? And then I found actually Coke has a website that is full like derezzed 80s style, like hyper pixelated, low color quality. It's literally set in 1985. And on that website, you can actually now currently buy new Coke in Stranger Things, like packaging or in original looking packaging with some Stranger Things, regular classic Coke, you know, bottles with some Stranger Things labeling and stuff on it. And I've never had new Coke. And if anybody who didn't experience or live during the time of New Coke, you've probably heard of it, but if not, I'm going to give you a quick rundown. It was considered an absolute failure, one of the most terrible failures of marketing of all time. Essentially, Coke just changed their formula, slapped New on the top of it, and then just started putting that out, and effectively was just like, okay, this is what Coke is now. There was just massive, massive backlash against it. So much so that to this day, it's considered one of the most like marketing 101 things that you first learn about like what not to do. Because people had basically identified the brand with themselves and had decided that by changing that, you were changing them. And of course, you know, not even considering the actual taste and flavor differences, which some people loved, some people hated. Just the fact that it had changed was enough to like cause like a basically like huge letter writing campaign, and people were going out and saying that they hated it. So, mm-hmm. So the fact that New Coke is back and being produced again, is to me kind of a big moment because I never got to try New Coke because I'm only 31 and it came out in, you know, 85. And so I saw, you know, this old 80s style vaporwave style. It's, you know, grainy. It's, really digital. It looks like the old BBSs, bulletin board systems. And I'm just like, just fascinated by the fact that you can, you know, buy vaporwave style new Coke shirts, including, I forget what they call them, but like, I think they call them like high drift tees, like where it's like your whole midsection is showing and it's just like very like, very rectangular towards the top, like the belly shirts that were kind of big in the 80s. And like, they have all these like cool, like neon looking shirts and things like that. So as I'm looking at that, I just start like looking at what else is out there. And I find that in Burbank, a Baskin Robbins was turned into a Scoops Ahoy, and which is like super cool. They had like a whole menu. They had, you know, costumes and signage and everything. And then I think in Calgary, they had an actual fair, similar to the fair that was shown in season 3 of Stranger Things. And I don't know, should we like spoiler alert anybody that hasn't finished the season so we don't have to worry about what we say? Or
we might as well just kind of give everyone a disclaimer that everything beyond this point is spoiler territory, so go watch the season and come back if you haven't.
Yes, go watch the season right now. It's like only 8 episodes. I think the last episode's like an hour and a half, so you can binge it in like 8 to 10 hours. Definitely do that. So if you haven't done that, pause the podcast right now, go start watching it, and then come back and listen to us riffing on it, because it's very much worth your time. So yeah, back to Vaporwave, like you were saying, right?
Exactly. But you were talking about the Calgary Fair, right? At the end of the season.
So yeah, at the end of the season, there's a fair, very old school kind of fair with like a Gravitron and a Ferris wheel and all that stuff. And so they actually recreated that exact same fair in Calgary as well. And it turns out Nike actually re-released about 4 different pairs of their 1980s shoes, different high tops and things like that were only available back then. Apparently, I think you can see those in the season. I'm not like a footwear guy, so I don't really know much about that. I've never spent $130 on a pair of shoes, but it's there, and that's pretty cool. And they're like, they have this whole like, it's actually kind of cool because the Nike website actually has this whole like story about how a truck in 1985 was delivering its last shipment to, you know, some shoe store. It got lost along the way, almost Stranger Things like, and then suddenly it's come back and they found it. And so they're, you know, releasing those pieces of footwear to everybody. And so, you know, they're getting in on that. And then also Hot Topic has like Hopper's just super ugly paradise lounge shirt. You know, the 80s style, just ridiculous, over the top, bright colors. I think H&M actually also put out a couple of like semi-expensive, like $75 shirts that are similar to what Eleven wore, like the yellow, black and yellow shirt she wore, and then the like really like super multicolored shirt that she wore as well. So like, I was just like researching all this stuff. I'm just seeing all these different companies and products doing all these crossovers. And I'm just sort of realizing that like, in order for all these companies to be partnering together, there must be a market for this, you know, like there must be a big market. Cause if it was just like a little bit, you just see like the little Funko Pop figurines being sold and like maybe some like keychains or something, like if people weren't buying the crap out of this. But if you've got all these different big name partners, like this has got to be something. Like people have to be getting invested in this into themselves. And this idea that, especially when it comes to like clothing separate from like odds and ends and figurines, is like, I think that's a step saying that people want to wear their nostalgia, which of course they've been doing for a long time. But this idea that by wearing the nostalgia, you're actually re-invoking it as if it was there for the first time, because there's going to be a whole set of people that never saw that or never had nostalgia for it. Mm-hmm. And those people will just be seeing that style in the world around them. I mean, we're definitely not to the point where 80s is saturated in everything right now, but I can definitely see that this feels like this is where it's going. It feels like everybody is kind of getting back on the 80s is awesome, you know, train here, whether it's Ready Player One, which was just steeped in 80s culture and references the movie, slightly less so than the books, only because it just can't do justice to the same length as a book. But that entire world, if you've never heard of Ready Player One, it's about virtual reality and how the whole world is basically a virtual reality world based on everything hyper 80s, to the point where the adventurers of that time have to have memorized almost every single 80s movie and be able to recite it word for word. Mm-hmm. So I was going through all of that, and I was just like, I just kind of had just my mind was just blown. And so I just kind of started like riffing at you, and you know, I was thinking to myself that like it almost feels like the 80s was sort of cresting the hill of the pre-internet era. Now granted, I mean, we had, you know, bulletin board services, things like that, so I'm not trying to discount that, you know, the 80s was you know, there was nothing that came before that or no precursors to it, but effectively in the mind and the consciousness, that there was no real internet for most people. It was still things like you see in the third season, ham radios, walkie-talkies, and things like that.
Yeah, so this is a good moment to interject, too, with an important historical moment that season one situates itself in, which is the threshold between 1983 and 1984, right? And we know that in 1984, Apple Computer, J.F. Martel makes the same point in his essay and in the podcast that we did a few years ago. 1984 was the year that the Macintosh was formally announced and started to be purchased and went into the homes of everybody. And it really kind of symbolically ushered in the age of the personal computer for the first time. So, and you know, computers had been around before then, and there were other campaigns going on and other companies going on that were trying to compete with Apple. But symbolically and historically, Apple's been remembered now for that famous 1984 computer commercial, if you remember, right? Like, 1984 won't be like 1984. And it has that 80s woman in the athletic 80s gear swinging the sledgehammer into that kind of Big Brother video screen, and everyone else is sort of wearing this dull gray drab sort of collectivized attitude in the commercial, and she's this one sort of liberating everybody. Very interesting commercial. But Martel's point is that, you know, the 80s and the early 80s to mid 80s was really the last time we were still analog. And we've never been that way ever since. I mean, it's a completely different kind of world. And you and I grew up in that analog world as kids to some degree. I don't think really our parents allowed us to be completely captured by the digital. And not a lot of kids in the mid-90s to early 90s were too situated in the digital. It just wasn't that present yet. It's this different reality that wasn't completely online, that wasn't completely mapped out and digitized. You know, in our conversation, we talked about it. There's a feeling these days, and we've experienced this increasingly as we go into the 2000s further and further, that everywhere you go, the lights are already on, right? There's already an expectance of you in that room. You're already being tracked and marked, and you're on a map somewhere. You're on Google Earth somewhere. Your phone always knows where you are. You're always on the grid. There's no way to get off of it. But in the 80s, and really in our childhood, there was this moment where digital technology hadn't completely flooded our environments yet. So Stranger Things, and really, like, we're talking about nostalgia, right? And this is a question to throw back at you too. And it's this idea that, well, why, what is it about the 80s, and what is it about analog technology and the 80s being the last moment when we were still in it? That's so interesting for us in our generation, the millennials and onward. We obviously are obsessed with it, and it's only become more so as we've gone along through the 2000s. So what is it about analog that's so enticing for us? You know, what is it about that environment?
Okay. So, you know, there's a lot of ways you can approach this subject. And of course, probably many people have kind of done more holistically the whole thing justice. So, like, a great example is, like, if you ask what it is about analog to someone that's like a wood carver, they'll give you a different answer than someone who like maybe made like electrical boards, you know, when they were still, you know, plugging transistors into, you know, breadboards, and they could still hop down to their local Radio Shack for the pieces and parts that they needed to do their little experiments. But I actually think that it's kind of a broader thing than that. Not that those don't have, you know, perfect merit there. But okay, so like in the 80s, now I was born in 87. So, I mean, I'm talking about this from basically an early 90s being the holdover of the 80s. So I'm sort of looking around, and everything is still fairly late 80s in, you know, in the early 90s. The interesting thing is that I feel like people in general knew that technology was getting bigger. Technology as a thing, as a thing that people were doing. Let's say, like, technologism. Technologism is something that people had only relatively recently been doing, because there really wasn't consumer electronic, consumer technology up until relatively recently. I mean, of course, you had businesses going back to, you know, the Industrial Revolution and things like that. Those were technology, but those weren't really consumer technologies. You know, you didn't have tech in the home in the same way. And so I think that in a lot of ways, what the 80s sort of stands for is it is the rise of technology in our individual lives. And you can see that because, you know, you can see that with like the boom boxes that, you know, that you hold and you strut around with. You can see it with ham radios that you see in Stranger Things season 3, you know, that the kids put together this big giant, you know, communication satellite tower thing on a hill, you know. You know, you've got the Walkman, you've got the Macintosh. And I think that everyone was in a way jiving into a near cyborg state, and it was very exciting, and everybody wanted to do it and show it and be it. You see that actually in a lot of ways, even in Stranger Things, where, like I said, the kids are interacting with technology, the kids are using the walkie-talkies together. You know, it's more convenient than the telephone. You're not taking up your parents' single landline, you know. You can directly talk to your friends. You don't have to worry about a busy signal. You know, things like that. This idea that the individual kid now has sort of access to their friends, their environment, their community, their culture through these pieces of technology here. I almost feel like it's when we were celebrating cyborgism. And the reason I say that is because I feel like the 90s was a bit of a turn. So the 80s is, hey, look, we've got this technology. It's big. I want to show it off. I like that it's large. You know, the cell phones, I believe, of the 80s were just like these huge brick things. The few people that did have them, car phone type thing. You know, obviously, ham radios are large. The Macintosh was, you know, while it was smaller than supercomputers, it was still pretty big. It wasn't portable, but it was definitely something that people were sort of sharing. You also have the rise of the video game consoles, so gaming is actually coming back into the home, whereas arcades up through, you know, the early 80s were sort of where it was at. You start beginning to have the crash of the console era, and then the re-rise of the console era, I believe technically would be about 88 with Nintendo, the first NES, Nintendo Entertainment System. And so what that is that people are starting to kind of come back into the home with their technology, but when they go out, they sort of wear their technology, you know, the boombox on the shoulder, you know, the headset that you see Dustin wearing throughout the show, sort of really showing off, hey, look, there's this technology that I'm using. You know, someone holding the boombox on their shoulder is literally going, ah, look at me, I'm this cyborg, you know. And then into the 90s, you actually have a change in culture, which is almost like, if I'm going to have technology, I don't want to be strapped down to it in a way. So you have sleeker cell phones. You get cell phones that now flip open and their antennas telescope into a shorter range instead of the really long range, you know, telescoping antenna that you used to have. Computers, I believe the first laptops come out into the 90s. So this idea kind of becomes that, well, technology is this tool. So if I'm going to be a cyborg, it better integrate better. And this idea that I'm not celebrating my technology in the same way, it's not necessarily old hat, but it needs to be understated, you know. And of course, that also, the idea of it needs to be understated also goes with the culture of the time, which is grunge rock. It's I don't want to stand out. I don't want to look like anything, you know, over the top or crazy, like you're moving from hair metal to Smells Like Teen Spirit by Nirvana. Yeah. You know, this idea that you're wearing flannel, darker colors, the loud colors of the 80s are out. The vaporwave aesthetic of the 80s are not there anymore. It's be low key. Low key is cool, you know?
Right.
So,
yeah, that's, I think you're bringing up a few interesting points here. And I think what I'm hearing from what you're saying about the 80s technological self that was just beginning to be imagined as a cultural identity was very attractive. And the idea of wearing kind of, so, okay, there's this famous image. I think it's from Mondo 2000. Are you serious? It's a magazine clipping, right? And it says, are you a cyborg, right? And it has this guy wearing leather. He kind of looks like an 80s punk dude. And he's got a giant cell phone, the exact one that you were describing, the really big one that looks like a brick. He's got all of these straps and technologies kind of hanging off of him. He's got this giant personal computer he's lugging around that looks more like a typewriter. And he's got all these things, but they're all on his person. You know, they're all kind of surrounding him and it's asking, are you a cyborg? And there was this idea, and I think this is the biggest thing, not necessarily what the technology was technically, physically capable of doing, because it wasn't capable of doing much. I think it was the idea of refashioning the self and everything that technology stood for, freedom, self-expression, surfing, you know, with William Gibson and the idea of the Matrix. So it had this kind of virtual, imaginal image of the new self in this new technological society. And the myth of the new self was that you could fashion yourself however you want to be. You can have all of these extensions of your being that give you all of these new powers. And so technology was more like a fetish, I think, in the 80s. And it really kind of helped reshape what the self could be. There was a new myth of the self. And the technology was the kind of the adornments of this new self and the new possibilities that the technology and the personal computing age helped create for us. And, you know, with Steve Jobs too, what Steve Jobs was saying, you know, if you read Isaacson's book or just any even of the sort of biography films about him, he was sort of capturing this idea too. And he understood the power of myth about this new self that in that commercial, again, it's shattering the establishment. It's being the sort of radical with all of these new possibilities. And the technologies of the new self enable us to actualize ourselves and the individual in this whole new arena of possibility. So there was this real, I think, a tremendous energy around the new mythologized self-sense and the possibilities of this new techno self or cyborg self that was opened up in the 80s. In the 90s, what's interesting is, I mean, we can kind of like throw in even some of the socioeconomic factors that were going on. I mean, in the 80s, we had a conservative turn politically and economically with Reagan, and it was still the Cold War. So a lot of these more radical ideas were actually, in some sense, kind of running against the current of the 80s, against the Reagan 80s. I'm not going to say that Steve Jobs was, I mean, he was a capitalist, obviously, and it was a very successful business and all the traditional capitalist senses. But the idea of this revolutionized techno individual still had this kind of countercultural potential that a lot of people talk about. Like Mondo 2000 is a great example, and it was blending with like Timothy Leary, who was you know, really getting into cyberspace towards the end of his life. He was really kind of into that stuff. So there was this countercultural sense about the possibilities of becoming a kind of a techno shaman or something along those lines, right? And then in the 90s, though, as you're saying, like there's this kind of slimming down or capturing of all that potential, right? We have Francis Fukuyama talking about the end of history. It was the Clinton era. The Soviet Union had, you know, the wall came down when we were little kids, you know? So it was a new era, and it was really the end of the era. And it was sort of saying, okay, we have the capstone of history. It's capitalism. It's neoliberalism. It's the mall, you know, it's the shopping mall, and you're a consumer. And yes, tech is fine, but let's understate it a little bit, okay? Let's slim it down. Let's make it work for the office. Let's get pagers and beepers and all that stuff and kind of fold it back into the American consumer suburban lifestyle, where I think technology originally was really a lot more disruptive. You know, it had a lot more potentiality behind it. At least the culture and the myth around the technological self in the 80s was just a lot more radical. And it kind of got subsumed, like you're saying with grunge, right? Like the culture and the music of the 90s kind of got subsumed a little bit. There wasn't really the sense of breaking out of things anymore. And even with the personal computer getting very democratized and everybody being on the net, you know, even with the dot-com boom, you know, there was this sort of, well, capitalism has figured out the internet now and digital technology. And of course, that all crashed with the dot-com bubble. But still, there was this sort of, as you're saying, there was a subsuming of these radical possibilities that the 80s was glorifying, because it was still a kind of a virtual object and not an actual physical thing that would be like captured by the mundanity of life and economic systems and so on, right? It was sort of a potential, which was so exciting for us. The other aspect of Stranger Things, which hits a lot of nostalgia for people, is exactly this sort of challenging of the American suburb, the unconscious of the paved over world by the upside down, right? Spielberg was really good with this in the 80s and in the 70s, this idea that what appears to be the normal waking reality of normal waking everyday middle-class suburbia actually has a stranger thing going on underneath the surface, or right. ETs showing up and in, you know, on the fringes of the neighborhood, or there's, you know, a poltergeist, you know, there was all of these things that were always creeping into the suburb that were disrupting and re-enchanting the world, right? There's always a threat.
Right.
So I think that's another reason why people really like this show, because it's sort of, it's sort of reminding us not only of the potentiality of all of the fetishization of technological objects and how they could be portals to other worlds, but that, you know, the suburban flatland can actually open up to something weirder, you know? And I think that's part of the attraction.
Yeah. Well, you know, I kind of think of it as the 80s is, in a lot of ways, it's sort of like in its most ideal states, obviously, not in every location, and certainly, you know, socioeconomics aside, because not everybody had access to, you know, hyper-consumerism in the 80s, of course, but in its most ideal states where it was occurring, it sort of feels like it's the last time that people could really be kind of like avatars in a lot of ways. So like, just think about like 80s culture with like the neon signs, the vaporwave, well, we call it vaporwave now, but it wasn't really called that then. But you know, the vaporwave style, it was neon, it was bright, it was hair up, and it was, you know, put to the side, and, you know, and there was punk in there. And just this idea that almost like everything was a cosplay. You know, obviously, you know, is what we would think of it as now. And so, especially coming from previous eras where culturally you didn't have that much diversity of clothing and styles and looks and things, you know, I think that for many people, that was something that was kind of difficult. If you weren't ready to sort of avatarize yourself, if you weren't really ready to move into that next phase, the 80s was probably really weird. And of course, you see that in season 3 of Stranger Things. You see people protesting at the mayor's office that this mall has come in. Because for those adults, and I do say adults because notice none of the kids were protesting the mall. Mm-hmm. You know, there was no young 20-somethings. It was all, you know, grown men in their 30s, 40s, and 50s, men and women actually, protesting the mall. Because the world they knew it, or they knew of up to that point, was something that could in no way have made room for what the mall brought. You know, you have your one hardware store, you have your one or two hobby shops, pre-mall. And the thing about those areas were, they were your cultural hubs, but people who weren't interested in those things or those ideas, if you weren't getting hardware, you wouldn't go to the hardware store. If you weren't a hobbyist getting hobby stuff, you wouldn't go to the hobby store. And depending on locationality, because everything is sort of spread out rather than, you know, super centralized, you don't even really have to come up against anybody who would get in your way of enjoying those things. You know what I mean? If you're parking on the street, you know, street side, right in front of the hardware store, you're not going to run into, at least not likely, some punk kids from the music store right next door, mm-hmm. you know, because the music store is way down the way. Whereas, you know, the mall is big, it's bright, it's in the way, it's environmentally unfriendly. It has music stores and hardware stores and hobby stores all right next to each other. You have to deal with kids running through, little kids just being sort of let loose in the area. The idea of like yelling at the kids doesn't make any sense because parents literally just let their kids, of course, they let them kids go wherever they wanted anyway. But, you know, the kids wouldn't find themselves in a hardware store just hanging out for the afternoon. You know, whereas in the mall, the kids would just hang out wherever, in whatever store, and any store would be something they might go into. And in fact, there's a brief moment in the show where you see the kids trying to look for a present, and they go into a jewelry store, and they realize how expensive the jewelry there is, you know, hundreds of dollars. And then they go over to like a Victoria's Secret, and they're about to walk in, and then they're like, ugh, too overwhelmed, and they leave. Whereas, you know, before the mall came along, the kids would never even you know, gone by a lingerie shop. They would never have even, you know, tried to go into a jewelry store. It would either be too far out of the way or too uninteresting. Whereas, you know, once you have the neon sign slapped on it and it's, you know, 5 feet to the left of the store that you're at, and then there's a food court right across the little strip there, and it's got all these different flavors. And, you know, I think they sort of you sort of poke fun at the hyper mass produced flavor sensations that come out of the 80s, like the icy. You know, there's a whole thing about ices in that, and they make a joke that they say it's just sugar and ice, so it's the same thing. And of course, anybody that's had an icy would know that sugar and ice is, just does not do justice to the many flavors you can have of icy. And so, I think in a lot of ways, you have this sort of pushback towards people who thought that culture was something that they were co-creating rather than culture as a stream that you had to dive into. This idea that, you know, if you were at the hobby store, you were kind of creating your own hobby culture. Whereas in the mall, the store with more people coming in and out of it, it's getting more business. The more people that you see, you know, going into it, it's more alluring, you know. It's kind of interesting because, you know, in the 80s, you have this sort of pushback where people are kind of going, hey, I don't want the things that that I'm into to go away, because they kind of had been going, I really want what I want to still be the way that I had it. And so I feel like what happens is that they sort of knew that the mall would fracture and slightly cloister us into the, maybe potentially into the internet era that they didn't know was really coming. You know, the internet era where whatever website, at least in the 90s you were in, that was the website you were into. And you might not, there weren't that many websites that were popular, but there were so many websites that anybody could be anywhere, you know. And so this anybody can be anywhere thing makes it so that people aren't everywhere.
Yeah. Yeah. You know? So with the mall, right, you know, I keep thinking of the cultural critic from the turn of the century in World War II, Walter Benjamin, and he wrote a series of essays collected in the Arcades Project. And this is so interesting that the mall in itself is a kind of a retrieval of the arcade, which was a sort of, it's funny, they're antiquated. St. Petersburg, Florida, where I live, as some listeners know, has a few arcades actually on Central Street, which are from about, you know, 70 or 80 or maybe even 100 years ago when the city was first coming up. And they're just, you know, a hallway with a few stores, and it's enclosed indoors. And it kind of takes the idea of the downtown street or the village square where all of the shops are and encloses it in a building. And in many ways, the mall kind of reinvented that. And what you're saying, though, about, you know, you go to a hobby store and you meet other hobbyists, and perhaps you're able to kind of specialize in that culture, but you're kind of isolated and fragmented. You're driving in your automobile on the highway, you go to the store, you go home. You might meet people on the street, but in general, you're not in a public space where you're forced to interact with many other shops and many other people in the same way that you do at the mall.
And if you do, it's the same people in the same shops.
Exactly.
That you've been
so
seeing.
The mall, in some sense, was kind of bringing back what the American suburb had actually gotten rid of, you know, over the course of the 20th century through the automobile and the development of America's modern infrastructure and the highway, which began to separate local, very localized villages and towns where everybody knew each other. It took away the kind of the village life of America and replace it with the automobile life. Now with the mall coming in the suburb, all of a sudden is sort of, we've retrieved that in a very kind of maybe artificial sense, but there were still kind of moments of the spontaneity that would happen, like you're talking about. What's interesting though about this, and I kind of want to bring this into a question about today, because here's another intersection. We've gotten 80s nostalgia. We've got Stranger Things and all these, you know, you're talking also about Ready Player One. So there's a lot of nostalgia for the 80s. Part of what's going on today as well is the sort of cultural art form of I don't know what we call it, mall wave. Like there's all of these, there's a very famous YouTuber. Yeah. I can't remember his name. He has a fun channel where he explores dead malls. And the idea of the dead mall is just so fascinating right now for our culture. We love to watch videos of people exploring a shuttered mall and looking at all of the artifacts that, you know, I don't know, the fountain and the square and the fake plants, right? And the colors from the 80s and the 90s. And we just love kind of looking at this empty kind of spectral space. And a lot of times, people will play as part of the nostalgia trip. They'll play 80s music or 90s music, and they'll slow it down a little bit and have that kind of vaporwave vibe to the sound, you know, the sort of ghostly spectral 80s muzak that's playing as you're wandering an empty hallway, you know, mm-hmm. full of shuttered Macy's and JCPenney's. And there's, I find this to be really interesting. I was wondering what your take on that is, because in season three, the mall is the focal point of the whole show, right? It stands in for mm-hmm. the American suburban town. Season one and season two were doing different things. Season one focused just on the suburb pre-mall, really. And then season mm-hmm. two is like in the city a little bit. So it did something different. But season three takes us back to the American town, the American suburb, but it focuses, I think, very appropriately on the mall and the meaning of the mall. So I'll let you answer first, and then I'll throw in my two cents. But what do you think about this interest with dead malls and the mall being the focal point, the setting, and actually kind of a character in season three, right? It has its own kind of, it is a character of the season.
Oh, yeah. You know, so I think what it comes down to is I would say, what is the 80s in one word? And I would say, at least for the purpose of our discussion here, big. Right. Big is 80s. Big shoulder pads, big hairs, big boom boxes, big computers, big boaty cars, you know. Now, granted, you had your sports cars and things like that that were also, you know, big and everything like that. So I'm probably just making my own narrative here. But I feel like bigness is sort of where a lot of the nostalgia comes from, because in our own lives, big doesn't really happen anymore, unless you're going to a city and you're seeing cityscapes. You know, because of course, you know, buildings are taller and larger than ever. But, you know, our phones are smaller and sleeker than ever. The way in which people interact is less difficult, less hurdles to jump through than ever. Mm-hmm. And so, whereas, you know, in the 80s, you know, everything was because of technology, more arduous. It was larger, longer. You had to drive anywhere to get anything. Most things weren't delivered to your doorstep. And so I feel like in a lot of ways, there is a draw to big malls, because there's nothing like it in modern day. These days, at least down here in Florida, most of the indoor malls have all been effectively bulldozed and turned into just sort of shopping plazas now. And so it's half as many businesses, you know, effectively the same kinds of businesses in each and every one. So you don't have this sort of bigness. And I think the other thing is that you don't have a centralization anymore. So like a great example is like here in Florida, right? For people that don't live in Florida, you might not know this, but Florida is basically just a swamp that people decided to settle, at least, you know, in the lower parts. It's very hot, very buggy, very humid. And of course, as climate change gets worse and worse and worse, all of the negative effects of being outside get worse too. And so if anything, right now, an indoor mall would be more of a blessing now than it even was 40 years ago, right? And so I feel like in certain ways, the climate being less hospitable and then the ease of everything makes it so that the mall seems like this interesting relic, because it's a place that you could go and still be comfortable. And you don't really have that as much now, literally from the climate controlled setting. You walk in, you know, if I go to my outdoor plaza, if it's a hot day, the moment that I'm stepping outside, it's real hot. And if I'm not wearing sunglasses and a hat just to get to the next business, you know, 10 feet over, I'm just going to be sweating, you know, and I sort of want to retreat into the sort of hidey holes that are the plaza, and then kind of pop back out and get back to what I was doing. Whereas the mall was a big cultural center, you know, like a great example is with the portability of music. Your own headphones, your own Walkman, your own boombox. Suddenly you could take culture as it's always been described and ascribed through music. You can take that with you anywhere. Now you can suddenly share the culture that is your music wherever you go. I think that that's really big, because before that you didn't really have the ability to share that musical culture other than unless you went to like a dance club, disco, things like that. You know, there was no portability to your music, at least not as we think of it now as far as portable, you know. And so I think that the idea of the dead mall, it was this ideal of, hey, look, there's this place that you could go. And there's so many kinds of stores because there's so many different areas where small businesses and medium businesses can pop in and maybe they'll come and go. But there's always something changing. There's always something new happening at the mall. You know, maybe, I don't know, Cinnabon has a new flavor. Maybe the Gap has a new spring line or something, you know. And even if you're not interested in either of those things, the moment you walk into the mall, the smell hits you, the sight of the, you know, the spring sale hits you right there, just from walking around, not even wanting to actually consume it or even be interested in it, but literally just by being in proximity to it, you are becoming aware of it. So whatever the new big thing was, you were in much, much, much closer of a proximity due to the shape and style of the mall than you would be in a plaza. So especially today, like the idea of a giant indoor area where things are quicker, are right next to each other, this sort of this idea of, imagine if Amazon was a big giant building you could just walk into, is probably, I think that's why there's a fascination for the mall. And of course, that's aside from the nostalgia of people that did experience the mall, that did like the mall, that were mall rats in the, you know, the 80s and the 90s, and even into the early 2000s. But I really think that in a lot of ways, people feel like that's an interesting convenience that's gone, even though it's technically it's inconvenient to have to go somewhere to get your Amazon. I think it's just interesting because Amazon, being a singular place, wants to show you what it wants to show you based on algorithms of what you are consuming. It shows you other things that are like the things that you like. But by walking around the mall, you're exposed to a bunch of things you might not have ever heard of. You see things that maybe have no interest to you. You can at least, what I would say is, In those settings, you can at least brush up against other cultures, granted consumerist cultures, but the cutting edge of the most modern, most latest and greatest, whatever, you know. And the closest thing that I can think of to the last time that happened actually was when the iPhone came out. And I remember between 2006, 2009, if you were at a bar or if you were at a grocery store and someone pulled out an iPhone, like you would draw a crowd just by scrolling with your finger. And people would have silly apps like the lighter app where the flame moved when you moved the phone. And everyone was sort of like, oh, wow, holy crap, this is a thing I've never seen before. It's a spectacle, you know, and it got people interested. Even if you weren't a technologically savvy person, you weren't interested in email or the internet or app stores, all of a sudden, just this thing was just sort of drawing you in.
In this show, in season three of Stranger Things, the mall is featured as a very colorful place. It feels like a vibrant downtown cityscape full of a lot of different communities. Everyone's talking with one another. Everyone's, as you're saying, they're showing off their music and their kind of avataric self, the clothes that they're wearing, the technologies that they're featuring on themselves. And it's just sort of this glorious expression of late 20th century consumer capitalist middle class culture, you know, that's just sort of gloriously on display as a kind of a Titanic sense. You know, there's a kind of a Titanic sense about malls, in that, like, when we watch the movie Titanic, as glorious as everything is and as decadent as everything is, the underside to this is everyone knowing that this ship sunk, right? So there's a kind of a fascination with watching this thing head for the iceberg gloriously, magnificently, you know, as this tremendous triumph of modern technology and industry and aristocracy, et cetera, et cetera. And I think the malls are good examples of this. They were just so bright, so loud, so triumphant about the end of history. And yet they were all headed for the iceberg, you know? So there's a temporal aspect, I think, to our nostalgia and fascination with the dead mall too, in that, you know, we just, at the other side of it now, you know, we're no longer in, you know, the middle class is shrinking, of course, and malls are dying all across the United States. So the world that is being featured in the 80s is already a world, even though many of us were born into it, that's gone. You know, that world is over with. And I always think of McLuhan when he talks about the basically, when one medium is done and a new medium emerges, the old medium becomes a work of art in the new medium. You know, you kind of fetishize typewriters now that we're all, you know, techno laptop you know, tablet oriented people, but we love the clickety clackety mechanical keyboards, and we love even more so typewriters, and we collect them. And there's like a revival of typewriters right now because it's a world that's already closed down, you know. And I think the shuttered mall is this world that's already over, you know, that the American suburban consumer culture is already done. And so there's this kind of, it becomes a sort of creative fascination for a kind of a spectral world that's now kind of haunting us, leaving its glorified ruins, you know, in every single suburb in America, you know. So I think the Mark Fisher calls it hauntology, sort of like the presence of a thing that's kind of dead, but it's still kind of there. There's a kind of a hauntology of the mall that's sort of just lingering in the landscape of American suburbia right now. We're loving it. We're just loving it up,
right?
Because we're a new culture. We're this weird, I wouldn't say we're becoming urban necessarily, because a lot of us still live in the suburbs, but there is this sense that the new commons and the new social space is no longer the mall. It's like the internet, which has its own problems. And we talked about that too in our conversation, the fractioning and the culture wars and no one being able to talk to one another. And so there's a lot of cultural fragmentation. So one of the other things about the mall and the world that's closed down now is that was really one of the last moments where, as you were saying in our conversation, that, you know, the commons was still kind of around, even if it was artificially retrieved by consumerism in the mall, it was still kind of there. The mall has been a repeated motif in zombie films for since the 70s, really, since the malls became a big thing and started to really pop up everywhere. The mall was an image of, you know, you have in Dawn of the Dead, the shambling consumers in the mall, and the image that's always been taken to heart by a lot of like culture critics. You know, the mall is this sort of image of the undead mass consumer. And so I've read this too about you know, dead malls being an interest today, is that the deadness of the mall is actually a feature. It's not a bug. It's actually the shadow side, as it were, of the mall. You know, there is this kind of consumer droning that's taking place there. And so, you know, people, artists pick up on that, and they use it for sci-fi and they use it for horror. And so it's sort of like, it's a built-in feature of the mall, is its own spectral nature. You know, it is its own deadness, as much as it's, you know, a triumph of capitalism. There's an underbelly to it, which brings me to the show, because in the show,
right,
you know, the town is a symbol for the American suburbia. You've got the above world, which is the 80s America, suburb, middle class, etc. Then you've got the upside down world, which is this kind of shadow side, you know, sort of the unconscious of American culture in some ways, or at least it kind of symbolically represents that. I mean, it's hard to not make that connection, you know, of, okay, everything, it's exactly the same as the above world, except everything's dark and it's full of weird creatures, etc. Again, that Spielbergian trope of the weird sneaking in the underbelly of the apparent normalcy. So we've got that, but in the mall, things are switched up a little bit, because it's not just the upside down world that's a symbol of the unconscious or the shadow of America. In this season, it's literally a communist base that is the underside of the capitalist mall. So
yeah.
I don't know what the show creators were trying to say by that, or if they were trying to say anything or make any kind of statement, but I do find it really interesting.
Well, like, so, you know, when you talk about dead malls specifically, is I think the thing that people pick up on with dead. Okay, so it's probably a little bit animistic to think of it this way, but even though the mall was this place of, you know, hyper-consumerism, middle classism, and it was an attempt to revive the commons, if you think about it from the perspective of the kids in the show, the mall was none of that. You know, the mall was fun. The mall was just fun. The mall was taking out your binoculars to try to look at which one of the people carrying a duffel bag is the real Russian. You know, it's this place where you just imagined these fun times with your friends. For other people, it was the place that they went on their first dates. It was the place where they had the first kiss with their future wives, potentially, and husbands. And it was the place that they first discovered or first bought a CD by what would be their favorite band. And so I feel like a lot of the energy from those things are what is drawing people to the dead mall, because that doesn't go away. I mean, that's, you know, 10, 20, 30 plus years of most of these malls being in existence. And that's a lot of time. You know, that's a lot of memories. That's a lot of individual moments. It's, you know, whether it's stressed out Christmases, back to school shoppings from season after season. It's where you might go to get your first prom outfit. It became this emotional hub for anything that you might want. You would have more and more memories tied to that. I feel like in a lot of ways, that's what people see now when they see the dead mall, is they don't see the money going through, and they don't see the potential for a deep, dark undercurrent of dark capitalism's shadow side. They just see the memories, or the potential for memories. They see that the moments of captured time where everyone was going there to have different moments. And because of the variety of things and the changing nature of it, I feel like it's so different from anything else that came afterwards or since, or really could come afterwards or since. And so I feel like in a lot of ways that's what the dead mall is a place of memories.
The last kind of cultural place marker, right? So in the 80s, there were a lot of films about the 50s. Spielberg and everyone else were mm-hmm. kind of mythologizing their childhood. And so when we get to the 80s, it's sort of interesting that what you're saying is making a connection here, because George Lucas, his first film was
American Graffiti.
There we go. So, you know, that was sort of glorifying the 1950s. Everyone had the greased back hair and the 50s cars, and they were making out in, you know, the specific park where everyone went to go make out on their first date. It was a romanticized and mythologized mm-hmm. version of their youth. And so I think what you're saying too is that the 80s and the 80s mall has become a kind of, well, memory mythology landscape of our own childhood, you know, where we grew up, where we came of age, where we went with our folks, you know, where what defined culture in all of its vibrancy in our youth. And so the spectralness of it isn't necessarily that it's dark and creepy for us, maybe for folks who were growing up earlier and making culture and producing culture in the 70s and 80s, maybe they saw the mall a little bit more conspicuously,
yeah. Like
Romero and Dawn of the Dead and so on. But for us, it has this kind of American mythology behind it. Our boomer parents mythologized the 50s and the 40s, and they mythologized their parents as the greatest generation. And there were so many films in the American landscape that mythologized and elevated that time period to be this kind of mythical American landscape. And I do think that you're right, that the 80s mall and the 80s suburbs have also become mythologized as this American, again, this American myth, this American mythical landscape that exists now only in our memory as this virtual space, as a place that we can kind of go back to in films and media as sort of the founding of our world, right? And it's another thing that I was thinking of as well, with not only with the mall, but with all the technology and the first computers and so on, and Stranger Things being set in that threshold between the internet age and the pre-internet age. It's the founding of our world. It's the moment where our world was born, you know, and that those were the conditions. Those are the environment. We had malls, we had suburbs. Yeah. Tech was really big and clunky, but everyone had a sense of the direction things were going, or at least they were really excited about the personal computer and the internet and cyberspace and all of these things were still ideas, but they were the kind of the fecund ground in which the internet age was born. And so we're going back. That's our ground zero, right? That's our source. This is where things got started, literally where we were born, and literally where everything that has shaped the world since, in terms of Apple computers and the internet, really took off. And so we're going to carry that with us as a sort of, it's sort of a mythological landscape in which the new America was founded. The digital America was founded. The 1950s did the same thing for our parents. It was the age of rock and roll and Elvis Presley. And, you know, right before the hippies in the 60s and the liberation of sexuality and conservative culture was all kind of breaking apart. Here's another turning point, the 80s. The technological revolution was about to rip everything open and change everything. Should we extrapolate at all on the Soviet underbelly of the mall?
If you look at Lethal Weapon, it's the Russians have diplomatic immunity and they're doing stuff, you know, around us that we can't stop, but we can see them doing it. But all it takes is one rogue man to stop it all. You know, the Russians as the big bad, the Cold War ideas of like nuclear proliferation and what it could mean to have something, again, like we were talking about, big mall, big hair, big shoulder pads, big boom. I mean, that's literally, everything is big, you know? And I feel like in a lot of ways, that's what the Soviet Union was. The Soviet Union wasn't, while it was like economically, like not very rich, didn't have really high GDP, and many other nations in the world were dwarfing it. It was sort of the little big man. So I feel like that's the idea of this underbelly is literally underneath this hyper stylized, cool, slick culture of the 80s, this neon culture, big and bright, literally underneath all of that, you know, physically in the show, they show is the Russians. Like literally the Russians are underneath everything is like what the show is literally trying to say is no matter what it is that you are doing in your life at whatever age, the Russians have some effect on you, whether it's notable or not.
A kind of symbolic image of the world at that time is sort of wrapped up in the season three, right? You have the Soviet Union and communism as the underbelly of the American project of consumer capitalism, and they both kind of do this dance. You know, there's the regular topside world, and then there's the upside down world, which is the Soviet Union. So it's kind of interesting that in some sense, even though they are the boogeyman, that kind of world, you know, those polarities seem to be constant.
I think one of the things that we talked about the other day that I just I can't find a good interjection moment, so I'm just going to take it right here. And it's sort of that looking back, one of the things that I realized is looking at each decade, you know, 10-year decade, I kind of had this revelation. You know, the 80s was still a tolerance of discomfort. So the idea that you had to drive all over the place to get anything that you wanted because very little was delivered. You just tolerated that because there wasn't an alternative. Not having access to everything that you might want because maybe you have to order it and you might have to wait weeks for it to be shipped to you. Or, you know, you have no idea if there's going to be any tickets left available at the movie theater till you show up. Or, you know, so there's all these little discomforts in reality to the 80s that was just sort of this tolerance in general to, you know, to those discomforts or those lacking of high-tech creature comforts. Into the 90s, you have more like an apathy towards things that aren't comfortable. Like your cell phone is something that's now small enough that you can put it away and forget about it. Like it's not cool to want to always be on it. Like you're not a slave to it. This sort of idea that my technology is mine and I can do with it what I want. Whereas the 80s, since everything's still big and bulky, it's like, no, you're making a statement with this wherever you go. Whereas the 90s, you could fit a cell phone into a pocket or the bottom of a bag and not pay attention to it. And it wasn't ringing constantly anyway, so it wasn't requiring your attention. And so there's this sort of apathy in things that aren't comfortable in this way. It's sort of like an out of sight, out of mind. It's again, it's with between the hair metal going to the grunge metal, low-key, understated. And then in the 2000s, you have anxiety for the uncomfortable. You know, you have the 9/11 era. It's people suddenly shouting about freedom fries and caring about people who are wearing hijabs on their head and, you know, and everything. And so there's a sort of anxiety in general. This is where you have, you know, sort of the rise of the social anxiety disorder between 2000 and 2010. And so you go from, let's say, tolerance for discomforts to apathy for discomforts to anxiety for discomforts. And then I would even go so far as to say that the 2010s is, you know, from a geopolitical standpoint, especially noticeable. 2010 to now 2019 into 2020 is actually intolerance for the uncomfortable. You know, 2010, you see a really big uprising in people being very upset that we have a black president. The 2010 midterms was a referendum of, in a lot of ways, pre-white nationalism that we're seeing rise up today. And now you have Trump being elected in again, intolerance for the uncomfortable, the idea that for a lot of people, the, you know, immigrants are make them uncomfortable and they're not going to take it anymore, you know? So I kind of find that kind of interesting because I think in a lot of ways, that's why potentially the 80s is also a draw and why the mall is also a draw is because you could still find comfort in the uncomfortable or at least apathy towards what was uncomfortable, where it didn't really matter one way or another. It was like, okay, whatever, it is what it is. And it's just being addressed in its own way. And so I think especially today in the polarized climate of everything where things are, you know, so sort of tumultuous, it looks like a time of peace where, hey, look, everyone just cared about putting their hair up and going to have some fun at this central idea that was the mall, you know, and in a lot of ways, the mall is the internet. I mean, it really is like the mall is a tube, let's say, you know, it's a square concrete tube, but it's a tube nonetheless. And everything is closer than ever. And you have more and more kinds of things than you ever could have had on a single strip, you know, in downtown. You know, things are changing. Businesses are coming and going. Cultures are coming and going. Music is coming and going. Lights and signs and neons are coming and going. And you know, there's this sort of randomness or even chaos a bit, but it's a very controlled chaos. You know, and so I feel like that also kind of goes back to like what you were saying about like dead malls is, you know, we're looking through now a lens of intolerance for the uncomfortable, apathy for the uncomfortable, anxiety for the uncomfortable. And the last place that we reach where it didn't really have any negative connotations was the 80s, you know, is things that were uncomfortable just were, it just wasn't. You know, and that's not to say that there weren't racial tensions, of course, in the 80s, just again, more from like a consumerist standpoint, you know, driving to the mall to get anything that you wanted was a convenience, even though it, by today's standards, very, very uncomfortable. You know, well, you shouldn't have to drive everywhere for
everything. You just order something on Amazon and you can get it the same day delivered. You know, there's some warehouse apparently that's near your house that will, you know, take your food to you or whatever else your order, you buy an Amazon Kindle. We just went through Amazon Prime Day. So they're waiting. It has become a thing of the past. And this is actually something that J.F. Martel brings up in his essay, Reality is Analog. The fact that in the 80s, it was really the last time where you really paid it, or at least by contrast to today, you spent a lot of time waiting in line for things. For your food, to go shopping. And even though the automobile has kind of broken up the American landscape, by comparison, compared to today in digital culture, you had to get around quite a bit. There was a lot more room for the unexpected and just genuine encounters with other people in where you could not escape to your phone. You know, you're waiting online, you might strike up a conversation.
Yeah.
Because you're waiting online, there's nothing in your pocket to pull out to check, you know, your own little kind of micro world and escape from everybody else. You just had to deal with everyone else and everything else and the time it took to do anything and get anything done. And, you know, a lot of people say with today, even reading is more difficult in terms of reading things that are long form, like books, because there's just so many distractions and the internet has catered our attention to be really kind of fragmentary. So when it comes to waiting for things, when it comes to attention, when it comes to just dealing with things that you have to wait for or are uncomfortable, that was really the last time where we were still doing that, as you're saying. So like, maybe that's also the nostalgia too, you know, and we mentioned this too in our conversation leading up to this podcast, that really the 80s, it's not only the last time things were really analog, it was also the last time in which things are really analog, and we were imagining a world in which everything would be digital, but it hadn't happened yet. So it was really, really, I mean, quite literally, symbolically, you know, between 1983 to 1984 is the symbolic turnover. It's the threshold, and it's almost as if we're peering into another world as that world was peering into our own. And I think I wrote something to that degree in our conversation here. I'm just going to quote what I said. The mid 80s is like a weird looking glass where we can peer into the last moment we were analog. But for the 80s, we were the future they wanted to become. So we have enthusiasm for them, right? In our cultural imagination of what it was like to be analog, they had enthusiasm for us in what it would be like to become digital. And in many ways, of course, you know, what was realized and actualized isn't what we were dreaming of in the 80s. Very different. William Gibson always talks about that. I'm not a prophet, he says. Right. I imagine things to be really different. Nobody had cell phones and Neuromancer. I was totally wrong. But at the same time, you know, a lot of the underlying ideologies of digital culture are doing exactly what we wanted them to do, just in terms of like removing those gaps, removing the discomfort of waiting, isolating ourselves for immediate gratification, immediate instantaneous connection with whatever we want. But it comes at a quite a profound price, which is, as human beings, you know, a lot of our time is spent waiting. Like we've always done that, you know, as meat space creatures, we've had to wait and endure things that were uncomfortable. And being able to not do that anymore might sound good on paper. It might sound good abstractly, but I don't think we've really mastered what it really means to not wait for things anymore, because I think the price has been everything we've seen and everything you were just describing today, social isolation, cultural fragmentation. It's almost as if like we virtualize them all, but we've also kind of done what video games like MMORPGs do, where especially World of Warcraft in the later iterations, for the geeks who know the game, I think they call it instances, where basically everyone's in the same city, but you don't see everybody. You just see what's the people who've been loaded with you in that game, right? Or in that kind of instance. And a lot of it is, you know, again, the implicit ideology behind the internet and digital culture has been to eliminate those waiting spaces once and for all. Like Martel is in that essay, he brings up a quote by William James, and he brings up this good point that what William James is calling intellectualism, the sort of impatience for waiting for things, he calls them intolerable intervals. And I love that phrase, that turn of phrase. It's such a great way to sum up what we've tried to eliminate with digital culture. But he says, sensible reality is too concrete to be entirely manageable. Look at the narrow range of it, which is all that any animal living in it exclusively as he does is able to compass. To get from one point in it to another, we have to plow or wade through the whole intolerable interval. But with the faculty of abstracting and fixing concepts, we are there in a second, almost as if we control the fourth dimension, skipping the intermediaries as by a divine winged power and getting at the exact point we require without entanglement with any context. What we do, in fact, is harness up reality in our conceptual system in order to drive it the better. That's William James being quoted in Martel's essay. But I feel like, you know, this has been the project of modernity, you know, to actualize what abstract philosophy could only do.
You know, to take a far more modern example, the idea of a self-driving car, right? I mean, granted, we're not there yet where they're not completely self-driving. We can't go to sleep behind the wheel, but that's not that far off. You know, sometime in the roaring 20s, we're going to have that. That's just what it's going to be. Before we see 2030, we will have self-driving cars everywhere. You know, that's just going to be what happens. And so one of the things is like a great example, you know, family goes on a road trip, 80s, 90s, 2000s, 2010s, same exact thing, right? Get up early, cars packed up, hit the road early to try to beat traffics, right? That's every road trip for 40 years. But in the 2020s, that's going to change. And it's going to change pretty drastically in every way possible. So like a great example is when you have a car that can drive itself and you want to go on a road trip, it doesn't make sense anymore to really leave early. And in fact, it makes much more sense to leave at night. Why bother to stay up behind the wheel of a car you're not driving? So your road trip will start at, I don't know, let's say 10, 11 p.m. You know, everybody, when they're getting ready for bed, gets into the self-driving car, goes to sleep. 8 hours later, you're four states away, you know? And then even if you're doing, you know, a 12-hour drive or a 14-hour drive, by the time you get up, you know, you're less than a work day's length away from your destination. So you enjoy some time with your family, you screw around on the internet for a handful of hours, you play some video games together, or, you know, at the time it's going to be virtual reality, of course. You entertain yourself for the remaining hours. And that means that mom and dad are no longer navigating, mm-hmm. and there's no longer those like navigational arguments between mom and dad. And there's no longer the, oh my God, you missed the exit, you're an idiot, you know, moments. But then additionally, especially because I'm sure we'll be leaving at night more because, you know, why not sleep through the drive? So you're going to be looking out the window less, you know. I mean, already most kids aren't looking out the window. I know when I'm in the passenger seat, I'm looking at my phone. I hardly ever look out the window unless I'm in some place new with something specific to see. I mean, I glance, but I don't stare, you know, whereas when I was a kid, I remember I had my Game Boy, right? And the Game Boy, I don't even think lasted like more than like 4 to 6 hours. So, you know, your entertainment was really only so long. And you could try to play cards and things like that. But if your parents hit the brakes, like the cards went flying, you know, so you got like the little magnetic travel boards and things like that for board games. But, you know, at some point, everybody got bored. At some point, everybody got tired of talking and just wanted to look out the window. You know, in the 2020s, that's just not going to happen. You know, in when we have, you know, self-driving cars. So this idea of these intolerable intervals with traveling by car is going to get even worse. I mean, at least for me, I want what the 80s represented mm-hmm. to be more, I want to wear more of the 80s. You know, I want to show off more of the 80s. You know, I want people to do that again. You know, I love the vaporwave aesthetic. I love the neon. I love the big hair. I love the, you know, I just love the styles. I love the music. I love that, you know, it just mm-hmm. from the simple fact that it was a pre-digital era. It was really the last meat space era, because even in the 90s, you know, it's you know, everything was technology in the 90s. Everything. You know, everything in the 90s was technology, but in the 80s, especially in the early 80s, and then that cusp into the 84, mm-hmm. it was the last real meat space era. Like you mm-hmm. said, those intolerable intervals were just tolerated. It was just part of life. Whereas now it's literally, if my phone lags for 4 seconds between my clicks, I'm starting to get really pissed. I just can't stand it. And so, like, you know, I'm sort of infected by, you know, the world that I've grown up into. And I just like this idea of, I just like the idea of riding a bike. Like, when the hell was the last time I rode a bicycle? Like, high school, 2005? Like, you don't ride a bike, you know, unless you can't afford a car, or you're just trying to be like really ecologically savvy. But, you know, climate change is going to come around. It's going to make biking outside basically unbearable.
I think this is also why, like, you know, we're going back to mm-hmm, doing mm-hmm. these sort of like offline retreats that are happening a lot. A lot of people are going, like, again, it's intentional, but it's almost like a weird kind of monastic mm-hmm. intentionality where it's being woven into our culture to get offline, to get back into nature, to get back into crafting and getting, mm-hmm. you know, a hobby that's really hands-on, you know, and you could really kind of go and do, I don't even know, wood crafting, leather crafting, but you see millennials doing this everywhere. Everything's kind of relocalized and handmade again. You know, there's a newfound appreciation for the aesthetics of things. And then even with the technology, coming back at the end now to vaporwave, it's not getting offline, but what it is doing mm-hmm. is turning this digital environment into a weird space, you know, just the whole aesthetic of vaporwave and like 90s Windows 95 music and soundscapes and digital scapes. The way that vaporwave is remembering them is not exactly the way they were. It's weirder, but it seems to be getting to the kind of like the soul of 90s digital environments. You know, it's like that weird human imaginal space that actually right. motivates us to enter those worlds. When we were kids, that's what it felt like. Like vaporwave is what it felt like to be a kid in the 90s, playing with computers, playing with digital right. spaces. They felt ensouled and weird and
yeah.
and kind of animistic. I think, you know, we need to do that with our tech. We need to do that with the world. We're always imagining beings. And so I guess I'm just saying like what Rushkoff is saying, which is we need to triumph Team Human in this sense. Like, yeah, the only way that technology can help us is if human imagination mm-hmm. is mm-hmm. able to envelop it and make it into vaporwave and make it into 80s nostalgia and fetishize it and mythologize it. I think that's what's missing. Completely mundane question. Where do you think Stranger Things is going from here for season 4?
Season 4, holy cow. You know, honestly, I didn't see anything from season 3 coming. So I honestly can say that I don't know. But if we are moving from, you know, the early 80s to the mid 80s, I'm hoping that we'll see some late 80s, you know, going into the next season. So, you know, we've covered.
Yeah.
What have we covered? We covered things like Eggo waffles in the first season, you know, TV dinner, the proliferation of all the TV dinner options, to the arcade in season 2. And then in season 3, you have them all. You know, so what else is left for the 80s is sort of the question. You know, what else did 80s kids do that weren't arcades, malls, and just hanging out at home, you know, or playing in the woods? And I'm not actually sure what the answer to that is. I hope that one of the kids gets mm-hmm. a computer, and I'm hoping that they can uncover something cool for that. You know, so I'm hoping that the computer will get its moment in the limelight for the next season.
Yeah.
You know, and the other thing is the kids are growing up, you know, as we saw with this season and all the difficulties of growing up, this season by its conclusion mm-hmm. is the kids have begun to grow up and they are well within the, you know, the growing up phase, you know? And so, you know, the next season that comes out, they will be little adults in a lot of ways. You know, they won't be 10, 11, 12. You know, right now they're 13, 14. Next season, they're going to be 15, 16, 17. And high school. I mean, high school is the next season. You know, it's no longer middle school. It is, you know, you're deep in high school. You know, I'm not really sure exactly, you know, what other motifs that they're going to come up with. But I will yeah. say that I felt like season 3 was absolutely as good as the first season by far. Most of the second season was super solid, yeah. but I felt like the third season was an absolute triumph. Like it just hit everything perfectly. The acting was fantastic. The writing was fantastic. The themes, the callbacks, the transitions, the cinematography just absolutely blew me away.
I know it wasn't as popular, but my dream season would be a little bit more of the city scenes when Eleven kind of goes into the city and joins that kind of punk group of people with superpowers. I really liked the possibility with that, mm-hmm, but mm-hmm. they really ended that very abruptly. And that was a disappointment for me, but it did feel a little too early for that late 80s yeah. as we were talking about cyberpunk, punkish attitude, you know, just all of that Mondo 2000 style, like, fuck the system, mm-hmm. you know, personal computers, hacking, all of that stuff really kind of bring that to the forefront, especially if they bring yeah. up the computer, the personal computer. I want to see mm-hmm. like, I don't know, some one of the kids start doing hacking and having like, you know, those early Dungeon Dragon and Dragon kind of fantasy games on early or late 80s computers. Just that whole aesthetic of mm-hmm. early computers, fantasy role-playing,
yep.
hacking, cyberpunk, and supernatural. Just like mm-hmm. play with all that and I'll be happy. So we're coming to you both from either coast of Florida. I'm on the yeah. west coast by the Gulf in Tampa Bay, and you are on the space coast. So Yeah, we got to just keep this up, and there's just so much to talk about. We always talk about everything anyway, as you're saying. We'll be back. Definitely send us some requests if you'd like us to talk about anything else, especially pop culture related. Nick and I end up having a lot of conversations about the media that we're watching, so definitely let us know what you thought. So thanks again, Nick.
Thank you. Thanks for having me on.